Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the East-West Psychology Podcast, the forum for the exploration of psyche and spirit. Join our hosts, Jonathan Kay and Stefan Jurich, and their guests, as they delve into the intersection of psychology, philosophy, world wisdom traditions, the arts, and more.
In this episode, we meet Joseph Luizzo, MD and PhD, who is a Harvard-trained psychiatrist and Columbia-trained Buddhist scholar with over 40 years' experience studying the beneficial effects of contemplative practices on healing, learning, and development. Joe shares his story of founding the Nalanda Institute, New York City, as an intersection between contemplative approaches from Buddhism, psychology, and psychotherapy. The discussion focuses on the benefits and challenges of the scholar-practitioner model, and Joe shares his approaches to rigorous engagement between his training as an MD and his practice in the Tantric Buddhist tradition. The discussion turns to cross-cultural research frameworks, and we discuss his article, Contemplative Psychotherapy, which is the introduction to a new volume he is the editor of called Advances in Contemplative Psychotherapy, Accelerating Healing and Transformation. In this article, Joe speaks of the central importance of transformation of the body and how it can be beneficial to start approaching the idea of embodiment through the principles of spaciousness and light, based upon the Buddhist notions of the subtle bodies. All right, welcome to another edition of the East-West Psychology Podcast. Stefan and I are here with Joe Luizzo, who is going to be talking about founding the Nalanda Institute with us, and we're going to discuss one of his more recent articles. He's an editor of a new book on contemplative psychotherapy. Before that, I'd just like to read a little bit of a short bio about Joe, so you can get to know him a little better. So he's an MD and PhD, and is a Harvard-trained psychiatrist and Columbia-trained Buddhist scholar with over 40 years' experience studying the beneficial effects of contemplative practices on healing, learning, and development. He is assistant professor of clinical psychiatry in integrative medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College, where he researches and teaches contemplative self-healing and optimal health. He has taught the philosophy of science and religion, scientific study of contemplative states, and the Indo-Tibetan mind and health sciences at Columbia University, where he is adjunct faculty or adjunct assistant professor at the Columbia Center for Buddhist Studies. Welcome, Joe. It's fantastic to have you with us.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for inviting me, Jonathan and Stephen. It's great. Great to be sharing with like-minded folk and to be talking about what I love to talk about.
Hi, Joe. It's nice to see you.
Well, we could just start by hearing a little bit about your background and about the circumstance and the situation that led to founding Nalanda and what that institution is for our listeners. That would be really helpful.
Beautiful. Yes. Well, so I probably need to give a little bit of a thumbnail of my life story because I was kind of got into this trying to bridge these two very different worlds of contemplative living and learning with medicine, psychotherapy, partly because that's kind of what I grew up in. My dad was a therapist. Both of my parents were raised Catholic. I was educated in Catholic high school, which was actually a good experience, believe it or not. I had a wide range of interests. I was very interested in science, but I was also interested in spirituality and spiritual psychology. I was reading Jung as a young man a lot, and reading a lot of poetry. And I wanted, when I went to college, to to study the intersection of, I guess you'd say, maybe the psychology of religion or the psychology of spiritual experience or something like that. And in my first religion class, at the one end of the table was, you know, Bob Thurman. And that was actually his first year teaching. He had just gotten his PhD and done a little research work. And of course, he took us right into the unexcelled Buddhist tantras, the most esoteric and you know, provocative of all, you know, Buddhist teachings, I would say. But of course, just right up the alley of somebody who is a Jung junkie, right? What could be more like, there it was. There's the real living, like, here's Jung sort of going into musty, you know, libraries somewhere, digging up texts in Latin and Greek, which I could never read. But, you know, here at the end of the table was a real live human who'd actually been trained by real live humans who lived this stuff. So that really kind of hooked me. And it felt like that was the Buddhism was a perfect vehicle for bringing together the scientific parts of our culture, maybe the, you know, parts that have, you know, in some ways moved away over the centuries from spirituality and contemplation, with the contemplative traditions, which at least in the West are sort of at war or in Cold War or whatever kind of war with science. And Buddhism had a very different relationship. Like it was, had elements that were scientific, elements that were spiritual, and had its own kind of psychological core. So it seemed like just perfect. For when I started, which was quite a long time ago, I would say 40 years, that add a few since that was written. So when I started out, of course, this was not a field. This was just a crazy thing. My parents were worried about me. And of course, when I went off to, when I left college and went to medical school, I had to keep everything secret. Otherwise, I would have been, subject to all kinds of, maybe teasing, but more likely blackballing. And some of that sort of, that was a different time. But I persisted. It was just like, I guess it was my, deep-seated passion, craving, whatever, to try to bring these two worlds together. And fortunately, I didn't have to do much because the world did it for me. So after I did my residency training, I went to California for a while. By the time I came back to New York, Bob was at Columbia. There was an article about him in the New York Times Magazine. The Dalai Lama was, everybody loved the Dalai Lama. So consciousness had shifted and we were in the mindfulness revolution. And that's when I was doing my graduate studies with Bob. So I finally scratched the itch of trying to kind of not just be fascinated with Buddhist culture or practicing it, but being kind of trained as a scholar. That I was working in the psychiatry department at Columbia while I was doing my graduate degree. And the people in my day job said, well, why don't you start a center? So I started a center for meditation and healing at Columbia Presbyterian. And that became that was my experiential sort of initiation into trying to share this really in an integrated way with real people. And it was really thrilling. On the other hand, what I soon found was that at a conventional institution like Columbia, you can't actually do the kind of learning that you want to do at CIS and we want to do it in Nalanda Institute, because the institution is structured like in the psychiatry department. I could teach meditation, but I couldn't teach ethics or philosophy. In the religion department, I could teach ethics and philosophy, but I couldn't teach meditation. So it was just like the perfect example of how our culture is so siloed and conflicted, that I felt I needed to start an institution outside, an independent nonprofit. And that's when Nalanda Institute was born, inspired by the world's first university, and which was a contemplative university in India called Nalanda. And really partly because the Dalai Lama and others around him have taken to referring to the Tibetan tradition by really sort of as the Nalanda tradition, in honor of the fact that most of the leaders of the different lineages, the different schools, were Nalanda abbots or professors or members of the faculty at sister universities. So essentially, it's their way of saying, giving homage to the, but also creating a sense of unity and reconnection back to the Indian roots of Tibetan Buddhism. So it's kind of like a Nalanda is a kind of whatever, I don't know, euphemism or encapsulation for Tibetan Buddhism, you know, which then at the Institute, we try to integrate with Western disciplines, you know, neuropsychology, psychotherapy, social justice, you know, trying to sort of bring out the various dimensions of this ancient culture through dialogue with different disciplines that, you know, that interface or that are sort of interested in similar, you know, similar kinds of learning and transformation.
Joe, forgive me for my ignorance around this, but I looked up the website of the Nalanda Institute and was really interested to kind of look over the offerings. I know that there's an actual physical Nalanda Institute that's being rebuilt in India right now, right? I believe it's in India. And I'm wondering, I didn't see on the website whether there was a connection between the two or if you have any relationship with the people that are kind of reconstituting it over there.
So that's a great question, Stephen. I did actually go to the inaugural conference where the Indian government and a number of scholars sort of gathered at the sort of near the ruins of the old monastery, of the old Nalanda University, to inaugurate the new Nalanda University. You know, the thing is that from our standpoint, one of the complex issues of our day is that a lot of the money was coming from to do this great initiative was coming from the Indian government, and a lot of it was coming from the Chinese government, Chinese donors. So the Tibetans, who are the holders of the actual curriculum of Nalanda University, were not invited to the table. So in a way, I feel like, yes, I'm very much in dialogue with the Nalanda University lineage, but that's in the monastic universities in the Tibetan refugee settlements in South India, which is kind of my home monastery, and in Dharamsala and elsewhere throughout India, rather than the kind of ancient brick and mortar, the renovated brick and mortar institution, which doesn't have that curriculum, unfortunately, as yet, you know.
Thank you for clarifying that politics. That's fascinating, though.
Well, I mean, hopefully it will change. Hopefully people will kind of working together, because it would be lovely to see that. That the vision that is beautiful, that rekindling this, what kind of was like the university, the Harvard or the whatever, the Oxford of the Asian world. But unfortunately, you know, there's culture and politics involved, you know, history.
And I'm curious, like the interest from the Chinese in this endeavor. I mean, that's
So I'll tell you something about. I mean, Nalanda is it's a kind of beautiful vision in a way because, Bob Thurman's way of really describing how these Buddhist universities arose really almost 1,000 years before our great universities in Europe, out of the monastic, out of sort of mainstreaming of monastic education, right? So monastic education had been in the viharas, you know, that were set apart, and it was about people dropping out of a dysfunctional society, going to refuge, learning how to heal themselves, understand themselves, reconnect, re-engage with the world from a different place. But of course, as time went by, it became, you know, there became an appetite, let's just say, in Indian culture to bring this process into the mainstream, right? To sort of develop a monastic learning institution that wasn't strictly monastic. It was inspired, the guts of the curriculum was sort of the self-transformation, the psychology, the medicine that were developed by Buddhist monks, but it was open to dialogue with politics, economics, and, you know, architecture, the arts. And it was, you didn't have to be a Buddhist and you didn't have to be a monastic to go to Nalanda University. So it was in that sense a university in our day. And of course, it got very well funded. There really wasn't a dark age in India. You know, it got very well funded for 1,000 years, grew and grew. It was up to 10 to 15,000. And it was very pan-Asian in terms of its populace. So there were colleges from East Asia, from Japan, from Korea, from Indonesia, from Nepal, from Ladakh, from Afghanistan. There were you know, all these local, and of course Tibet, ultimately. So some of the diffusion of Buddhism to China was informed by monks, Chinese monks who went back to Nalanda to get access to more scriptures, to deepen their philosophical roots and training, and then come back. So Nalanda is very much revered and seen as part of the legacy of the Chinese Buddhist lineages. And that's why there's this sort of, you know, kind of sense of solidarity or investment.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, very, very clear. I was going to, before we jump into this article, you maybe preface this a little bit too, as you'd like, but contemplative psychotherapy, it's from a volume called The Art and Science of Individual and Collective Well-Being. Is that correct?
It's called Advances in Contemplative Psychotherapy. And I think that the subtitle is Accelerating Healing and Transformation.
Yeah. Okay, great. And when is this going to be coming out, just so our listeners?
In June, yeah. And this is the second edition. The first edition came out in 2017. And the Rutledge asked us to do a second, which was a great opportunity to sort of update and enrich the collection.
Just to do a short commercial for you, I was on the Amazon website yesterday looking at it, and you can pre-order it now if you'd like.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. We didn't know that. Thanks for letting me know.
One question that, and what one of the things that struck me among many things, but one of the themes of the podcast, which sort of unknowingly has come about, is discussing you know, I guess just trying to express different approaches to the scholar practitioner. That's really central to CIIS. And I came into academics after, I mean, I'm a musician and I wasn't involved in many academic pursuits before that. And I came into CIIS and for a couple of years just took it for granted, this scholar practitioner model. But as I met more scholars and as I got more connected to more mainstream institutions, I realized that it isn't necessarily this mainstream or accepted thing. It can be looked at as problematic by some, but it's very important in my work, but I think in CIIS for sure. And you start right off the bat in your introduction here to this volume, talking about the traditional scholar practitioners that you have in this volume, and you yourself being one of them. I was just wondering if you could just share, however you'd like, what that means to you, how you have come to define that for yourself, define that in your discourse communities, the challenges, the benefits, whatever couple around that, it would really be helpful for us.
Yeah. Well, you know, knowledge in the West has been, you know, fragmented and siloed for centuries and seen as sort of an essential sort of, you know, consequence, side effect of the search for objective knowledge. Very specifically, how did that search begin, or how is it understood, is as a distancing ourselves from our own human subjectivity, right? Like the very attempt is sort of get outside of our subjectivity, get outside of our humanity, which is seen as therefore kind of like a source of contamination or distortion or bias, and to kind of correct for that by sort of as Thomas Nagel, the philosopher of law, likes to say, having a view from nowhere, right? And that, so knowledge gets fractured because there's no human being at the center of it anymore. But this is the sort of growth of the Western university. There's no human being at the center. The human being doesn't need to understand themselves. They don't need to know how to live well. They don't need to know how to live well with others. They don't need to know the meaning of their life. All they need to do is gather information like a bunch of busy bees, like Francis Bacon said, you know, like worker bees gather information into the big hive, and somehow the civilization is going to move forward. So we know where that's left us, right? Is the civilization going off the cliff and everyone fragmented from everyone else and themselves. So yeah, that's where I see that the Indic tradition has a methodology or a sense of a method of learning, and also a standards of learning that are much more resonant with all the other cultures on the planet for most of history. I mean, there's not many cultures that have gone this particular way. So most cultures, it's really education and training. It's about becoming a good human being, a helpful citizen, community member, maybe gaining a skill, but at the heart of it is the cultivation of individual qualities and the embodiment of personal qualities. And that is viewed with great suspicion on the part of the modern academy, because the academy was sort of built based on a rhetorical argument that actually was impossible, that human beings couldn't know themselves objectively and well, that they couldn't be actually truly sociable, that they were inherently self-interested and competitive. And you just had to control people, the evil or ignorant nature of human nature. You just had to be sort of controlled as well as can be. And that's just, to me, that's the problem. That's the major problem with our current civilization and civilizational style, which is now going global through the internet and so on, is that it's taken the humanity out of human civilization, and it's put a lot of robots, robotic engines of knowledge and power and technology and information in the driver's seat. And it's, the humans who are supposedly at the helm aren't prepared for the job of actually ensuring that everything's heading towards some kind of, well-being, either individual well-being, collective well-being, global well-being. So yeah, so I'm very passionate about the idea that this whole model of knowledge at this point needs to be at least balanced. I mean, I think specialization of learning has given us a lot, but there's no hub, there's no heart, there's no center anywhere. And now if you look at my map for this, you may be familiar with the one particular Buddhist teaching that arrived late in the history of the unfolding of Buddhism in India, called the Kalachakra teaching, the Wheel of Time teaching. And that has a beautiful prophecy that actually we humans are finally going to get it together in a few centuries from now, the 23rd century, and that we're going to be able to sort of tame our own nature so that we don't need oppressive governments anymore. And we will have diverse communities and cultures, and we're going to be able to get along and learn how to be blissful together and creative together. But one essence of that is that spirituality is seen as a perennial science, right? An akshara vidya, a kind of scientific knowledge and skill or art, where that allows a human to bring the best out in the human being, human mind, body, heart, and that needs to be at the center of all the other disciplines. So there's disciplines, there's what they call outer sciences, disciplines that have to do with objective nature, astrology, astrophysics, geology, herbology, and so on. Then there's inner sciences that have to do with living things, like medicine, botany, and so on. And then there's the what I call the transformational science of human transformation, of getting, bringing the best out of our nature, getting over our evolutionary blocks of the survival, self-protective survival mode, and so on. So yeah, so that's my view, is that this is the future, that we have to actually, everybody has to have the scholar, practitioner, in the sense of bringing some learning and wisdom to how to be a human being. If we're not going to go off the cliff and just self-destruct and take the planet with us.
I was, looking at the table in your introduction, table 1-1, and I also struck by your kind of description of the arc of development, the kind of evolutionary arc. And I mean, I don't know why it should have would have taken me by surprise, but that in the third part of it, as you advance within this kind of pedagogy or in this mode of development, the final stages have to do with embodiment. And I think you might think from a Western perspective that the embodiment would come first. You build from the low, you would say that's the foundation, like in Maslow's triangle, you'd have to take care of all of the kind of the basics of the body, make sure that it's taken care of. But this is a very different way of looking at embodiment. It's preparing the vessel so that the spirit, I guess you could say, maybe metaphorically, can descend into it and carry it. But I was wondering maybe if you could talk a little bit about that, and also, this tension between science and spirit that you're addressing in your book and in your work.
Great, beautiful. Yeah, well, so agreed that, the body does appear in the very beginning of whether it's a yoga path or a Buddhist path, in terms of becoming connected with awareness, becoming consciously embodied and bringing benevolence to being in a living body, which we need more of. So that what we're talking about when we're talking about the third, I call them the waves of contemplative science and practice, but the third form of embodied practice is actually not strictly what's called the coarse body. That is the conventional solid material body. It's a way of bringing consciousness into intimate dialogue with our physicality in such a way that something kind of, new is created in a way, a new kind of embodiment that that is fully conscious, rather than having sort of this, largely unconscious roots in something somatic that we're not really connected to. It's learning to really connect to the roots, and also not just connect to the roots of our vitality, of our psyche, and so on, but also really tapping in very specifically to the kinds of what I sometimes call clean energy, or the kinds of capacities within us that are the most adaptive, the most beneficial, the most transformative. And so that amounts to a kind of spiritualization of the body, like a dematerialization of an ordinary unconscious embodiment, which is all about, is run by the delusion of separateness and the sense of self-protection, and instead tapping into the way in which the body is also the temple or the residence of our spirit, in the sense of the elements of us that are the most progressive, the most lasting and enduring, namely our capacity for love, for wisdom, all these things that are seen as kind of like our essence. So learning how to go into that, and essentially transform our embodiment. It's becoming aware of our embodiment, not just as a datum of evolution and conditioning, but learning how to bring full science, art, and consciousness and spirit and values into consciously kind of, reforming, picking those elements of our nature and our consciousness and energies that are the most generative and the most transformative, connective, beneficial. So it really is kind of an art of nowadays we talk about neuroplasticity, and genomic fluidity. It's really an art about creating the body, you know, from the standpoint of the higher awareness or spirit that really sees what is needed now, what is most needed, what is most beneficial for all of us, for our lives.
Yeah. Joe, I was wondering if you could discuss a little bit about how in your work this, multidisciplinary approach or cross-cultural approach as well, in terms of finding those, finding the places which things can start to resonate together, which they can kind of meet. It seems as though consciousness would be one place that science opens to and can be and through dialogue and through studies and whatnot and work like your own, you can kind of make a concept like that open up a little bit more than maybe the mainstream sciences are allow in a way. And then in the sense of the Eastern perspective, the Buddhist perspective, I mean, it's a different idea of consciousness in a way. And I'm just wondering how you, like, if that's a place that you're navigating the kind of the convergences here, and if you could kind of bring out that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, actually, if you don't mind, before I dive into that, which is a great invitation, I want to come back to an afterthought I have about Stefan's question. And that is, we talk a lot about the subtle body in both the yogic traditions and in the Buddhist tantric traditions. A lot of people who are interested in Buddhism are not aware that there is this esoteric form of Buddhist teaching that's resonant with Hindu tantras and other mystical traditions, I would say, like Sufism and Kabbalah and Christian mysticism. But we talk a lot about the subtle body, which there's been some really interesting new work done looking at the history of the concept and so on and so forth. But what people maybe don't appreciate, which I think is really worth bringing out, is that in a way the purpose of the subtle body, that is, what is a subtle body? It's an interoceptive experience that is able to open to the full capacity for well-being and open awareness or higher awareness or non-self protective awareness. But the purpose of the subtle body and accessing those core networks and capacities for well-being and transcendence and self-transcendence, that's at the core of our life, is actually arriving at what's called the extremely subtle body. And the extremely subtle, we think about the subtle body is far out, the extremely subtle body is so far out. And what it is really is something that, isn't really like a body at all. And that's, I think, something to be, in terms of this issue of spirituality and physics or science or whatever, in a way, it's much more like a quantum understanding of the fluidity, the total fluidity and total interconnectivity or field-like nature of life, of being, of embodiment. And imagine restructuring our consciousness and our sense of identity and agency so that that wasn't just an idea, but that actually we really were coming and living from that place of feeling totally interconnected with and part of our environment, our social environment, our natural environment. So like a kind of, it's a new level of consciousness as well as a new level of embodiment that is really addressed there. And I love as part of that, especially in the Kala Chakra, just a very interesting way in which they anticipated, so many things, but they anticipated quantum physics. They talked about that the fundamental nature of matter is not solid, but is space. And that there are particles, there are space particles out of which all the other particles, the solids, the liquids and gases and so on emerge. And of course that then makes it really much more, as David Bohm and others kind of have been talking about, and now we have lots of people that are panpsychists and so on, the understanding that if the fundamental structure of matter is space, then mind doesn't become so weird anymore, right? It's like it's not such an alien in the physical universe. It may just be sort of like a slightly supercharged or whatever different kind of space, an information space, right? So anyway, that's something that excites me a lot. And I think, it again, so when we talk about embodiment, we're not talking about, you know, just being more in touch with our ordinary sense of our physical body. We're talking about really a very different way of being embodied that is, you know, not trapped in the sort of Gnostic sense. It's not trapped in a physical body. It's discovering the physical body as belonging in and as not mine, as nature or universe in itself.
Thank you. That's really beautiful. Jonathan, I want to jump in just for a second, and then we can get back to Jonathan's question. But while you were speaking earlier, I was thinking while you were speaking about the rainbow body, kind of popped into my head, and thinking about the body as subtle body. And then I thought, well, maybe that's a little bit too metaphysical. I won't. And then I edited myself. I kept myself from saying it. But as you're speaking, what was coming to me was embodiment as spaciousness, that as and I was asking myself, well, what is health? I mean, it's not just mental health. I mean, what you're doing is psychology, but it's not just mental health. It has to do with the quality of the air that we breathe and the way we breathe it, the quality of the water we drink and the way that we drink. That's mindfulness, but also the way that we process it. And in order to process things fully and in a healthy way, we have to have a certain suppleness in our body. So we need to exercise in a proper way. And in order to be able to process all of this, we need a certain degree of presence. And that the ultimate goal is love. So that's what the embodiment was. And all of this was like coming to me. And then you stopped and said, no, I want to go a little bit further. And I want to thank you because you gave me everything that I was thinking, couldn't articulate. Really beautifully. So thank you. And I'm sorry, Jonathan, for interrupting.
Yeah, no, and I mean, I think that this whole idea of really discovering the way in which we are embedded, we are creatures of space and light. And you know, the fact that now science is kind of corroborating this in so many ways, that our physical matter is not solid, that our genes are fluid, that our brains are plastic. These are all elements in science that are coming, that are converging and reconnecting with spirituality, which again, for so many centuries, the main mission, I think the main research project of science was to find a way to explain reality that was completely opposite to and disproved in every way creationist, theistic, religious traditions, and guess what, we came out the back end, and we're back in dialogue with spirituality, whether we like it or not. And of course, I think we need it, as I've said like before, that if we don't have that bigger picture, like why am I here, what am I, where am I coming, and where did I come from, where am I going, what am I capable of, if we don't have that, then we're all kind of in the dark, you know, we're all just fumbling around in the dark, as we can see from how we're living. I mean, from a Buddhist standpoint, so the way we do interdisciplinary matrix from within the standpoint of Nalanda Institute is based on the basic disciplinary framework of Buddhist culture. Like, as you know, the foundation of all Buddhist culture, the first teaching the Buddha gave, the teaching of the Noble Truths. And that's a kind of therapeutic teaching. It's really about healing, and healing and liberation. It's both soteriological, spiritual. And it's also kind of medical in a way, or you know, healing the human condition, kind of somewhere in the middle there. But anyway, the essence of the path, which is the fourth truth, how do we get to experience the Buddha's, what the Buddha described as the elixir of immortality, as blissful liberation from, from bondage to, again, I would say, evolutionary programming, you know, delusion, you know, self-referential processing and so on. The path has three disciplines, right? So it's eightfold path. Since eight is a big number, we focus on the three disciplines. And the three essential disciplines are meditation, of course, obviously, but the other is wisdom, and the third is ethics. So the way we frame the interdisciplinary dialogue from a Buddhist perspective is, you know, meditation is the dialogue, you know, meditation as a discipline is in dialogue with neuroscience, right? How do we learn to calm and transform our nervous systems and the sort of matrix of consciousness? Wisdom is in dialogue with psychology, right? Because again, the one thing about psychotherapy that makes it near to my heart is that it is a scholar practitioner practice. It is an embodied practice. It is a practice that's unlike any of the, Lord knows how Freud ever managed to get it installed in Western scientific materialism, or, you know, a lot of sleight of hand, I think. But it is a place where we're practicing being human and really learning how to understand the meaning and purpose of human life and of our consciousness. It's phenomenological, right? By its very nature, experiential and phenomenological. So that dialogue is wisdom is you know, sort of like the insight that we need to be free, to live well. That's the dialogue there. And of course, philosophy needs to be in there too. Hopefully psychotherapy has a good, healthy dose of philosophy and spirituality in it. But then the other living place of spirituality is in ethics, right? And that's where we bring in social justice. So the dialogue there is, how do you live well with others? You know, how do you care for yourself responsibly so that you're not a burden or a harm to others or yourself, and you're well? Like, happiness from a Buddhist point of view is actually a social responsibility. Like, because a happy human is a non-harming human, and so, you know, that's the way we bring in the interdisciplinary sort of matrix, and you know, again, it sort of leaves lots of room for, you know, for us to cover a lot of territory, but it creates that sort of, you know, the whole human, the kind of holistic or integrative context. From a Buddhist point of view, that is what you need, you know, to really have an authentic, healing, liberating path.
Yeah, beautiful. And I would say also to get into a discussion of ethics that involves the more than human too, in a way, like, if we're going to use that word human, also that has a history in the West and humanism, for instance. But, you know, rather than the idea of psychism or cosmicism, and that if we acknowledge that we are a body in place and time, but we also have potential and different planes and parts of the being that spread or that extend to the cosmic, it's kind of decenters that human cogito, or the human in a sense, to open up to a really important notions that can help us engage, you know, more in an embodied sense, more in a sense in which we can actually hold the other, like whether that's the earth or the cosmic or another cultural being, you know, in a relational and affective relationship that is not so asymmetrical, or not asymmetrical at all.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is one way in which I think Buddhism is a kind of healthy, corrective or dialogue partner with the sort of traditional human, you know, anthropocentric, you know, spirituality in the West. Although there's all kinds of sacred activism and stuff like that in Western spirituality as well. But the idea being, yeah, of course, it's all life. All life is our family, right? And so that's, or breaking down the sort of human animal barrier. There's a little more challenge breaking down the you know, sensitive, you know, the barrier with plant life, but there's ways of doing that in the Buddhist tradition. But certainly there's an understanding, there's a way in which Buddhist psychology from the beginning was socially engaged. Like some, you know, a lot of people have sort of had this debate about whether the idea of socially engaged Buddhism is just like a westernized, revision. But it's clear from the Buddha's, who he chose to teach, the language he used, the way he structured the Sangha, the way he talked about politics, which he did talk about politics. It's clear that he had a political agenda and a social agenda of egalitarianism, of nonviolence, and of creating communities that are what, as you know, MLK would say, beloved communities, that are communities where human beings can be safe and thrive. And of course, there's also a way in which Buddhism is an eco-psychology from the beginning, because in Buddhism, your rupa skanda, like the physical material aggregate that you know we would normally identify as my body, from a Buddhist point of view, technically is my body and my whole physical environment. That's my rupa skanda. Like all the matter around me is also part of my rupa skanda. You know, so it's all really. If I'm going to take care of my body and understand it, I need to take care of the body of the planet and all the other life forms that support it. And that kind of is made more explicit in the Kalachakra teachings, where you have this sort of beautiful ecological vision of the planet becoming a medicine planet. You know, everything on the planet being learning how to take everything on the planet and use it as medicine as opposed to poison, obviously. And also the same for the social body, that the social body becomes that we understand that we're distributed through a collectivity of life that includes all sensitive things. So yeah, there's a lot of wisdom there for us to mine, and we certainly need it, given.
to try to work through some of these binaries that seem so absolute in how we inherit them. I'll speak for myself, but it is very much the worldview that I inherited came with these very hard binaries to break, and the privileging the type, the certain mind that can always figure out which one is going to give you a certain advantage or a disadvantage. And it's really that's not going to solve our problems. Stefan, do you have a question you want to jump in?
Well, I was thinking of two things. The question that I actually had, and then while you were talking, I was also thinking of what is it called? Spontaneous co-arising, right? That the idea that of the interconnectivity and how all of the parts are actually needed to form the whole. And then then the thought occurred to me that there's a decision-making process that goes into putting together a book, especially an edited book, and that you have very particular people that are, I'm looking at the right now at the table of contents for the older edition of the book. And I'm thinking that I didn't take notes on this, but there were certain people that you brought up in the introduction that you gave us to read that I'm not seeing their names here. And I'm wondering about maybe the decision-making process for bringing this particular group of people together, and if in a way that you're kind of putting together, trying to have people that represent many of these different pieces that we're talking about here. And then the other thing, if we have time, and maybe we don't, but I'm really interested in if there's in terms of, you know, dependent co-arising, that each moment itself is kind of sacrosanct. Each moment is itself the eternity. And if we're present, then there's no past and there's no future. There's still this prophecy of the future, that of the 23rd century. And I'm curious about, is that seen in the, in terms of karma? Is it like prarabdha karma, this idea that it's just the tendency? That's, I don't know how to articulate it any better than that, but you can answer either one of those.
Okay, well, so the book, the second edition, we definitely have an editorial wish to match what we're doing in pedagogically and in community in our teaching, which is to bring different voices in and to sort of help address the larger systemic issues and the issues of cultural appropriation and so on that, that are raised in the kind of work that we're doing. Right, so we do have, we brought in a number of, teachers who are ethical activists, sort of anti-racist activists, but who are also on our faculty, people like Lama Rod Owens and Jan Willis, who we just saw last night. It was just awesome. And really trying to address, as well as Camilla Majid, who's a therapist, who's a psychologist, who is looking at, the kind of dimension of, to what extent our psychologies are liberative, are truly liberative, to what extent they're part of an oppressive social system that pathologizes individuals and kind of individualizes problems, systemic problems, in order to kind of get away, to get rid of them or hide them. And so we're trying to bring these larger questions so that it's not just about the siloed profession of psychotherapy where you're just sitting with this one person and that's the whole microcosm, but we're understanding that that one person is, and we are in a system, in families and communities and cultures, and trying to address the systemic dimension, in part because we really believe that, community is one of the big gaping holes in our culture. Right. And that, this hyper individualism of modern culture has not only created these huge race divisions and class divisions and other divisions, but it's really, harming all of us in a very powerful way through enforcing alienation instead of belonging and community. So that is definitely part of this, vision that the Buddha taught, is that you have to have, in order for humans to thrive, and in a way it's like an indigenous teaching, there has to be a community that is a thriving, loving, holding community. And, again, so if we're going to be really Buddhist, we can't just be one Buddhist in a sea of competitive, capitalist supremacist culture. We need to change the culture so that the culture is supportive of liberation and awakening. And that, so that's part of the attempt of this new edition, as well as addressing some Tibetan scholars and practitioners who talk about the issues of how, from their standpoint, how the Buddhist tradition is being translated and applied in the Western world, to try to sort of really help keep us honest or open those dimensions of dialogue. As far as the sort of the vision of the Kalachakra, so, in the Buddha's lifetime, there's a teaching that, that the community that he created, the Sangha, the Bhikshu Sangha, the community of mendicants, would need to be extended into the lay community through creating what's called a Buddha Kshetra, a Buddha field, or a Buddha verse, or a liberative field. And the understanding there is that, that field of living beings is only going to arise to the extent that the beings that are in any particular culture, society, are developing themselves and getting support, being developed through the community. So that's the idea, is that, there is in Buddhist culture, it's not time is not cyclical. The Kalachakra teaching is often understood as about cycles of time, but it's really more about a kind of timeless progression. Like the evolution of consciousness is seen as timeless in the sense that we're all already have the capacity to be in utopia, to be in Shambhala, to be liberated, live together. It's all already happened from the point of the visionary point of view of the teaching. This is where history is going, and however, the history takes time to get there. So one of the great teachings of the Kalachakra is that the way that the Buddha Kalachakra, who is actually more like a kind of Christ-like figure than other forms of Buddha, it shows his compassion toward living beings by being patient with their own development. So like he sees where evolution is going, but he realizes that he can't rush people or living beings, that living beings need to take their own time to mature and ripen their consciousness and their embodiment so that they can actually support this kind of utopic vision. So that's kind of both the eternity is in sort of being deeply absorbed in the moment enough that you can see all the interdependent causality radiating out in space and time, right? You can see the future. You can see the past. You can see that there is no future and no past. But at the same time, on a relative level, there is, transformation, right? And so you also see that everybody else needs to wake up to that reality, and they're taking their time, taking their own sweet time to do that.
That's beautiful, beautiful description and vision. Thanks so much for sharing that. And I think that takes us to the end of this segment of the podcast. Our time is up in a very practical way.
Exactly.
But I think that that we should keep the intentions going and do something again in the future, maybe under our new concentration, which is called ACTS, Asian Contemplative and Transcultural Studies, who's organized, chaired by Debashish Banerjee, our chair. But I think that the two of you would have a great conversation and deepen these ideas. So Stefan, do you want to have them back in the future?
Yeah, we absolutely should do that. If you'll come. I really enjoyed having you come on and listening to you and chatting with you. I felt like we just barely scratched the surface of, your depths. So I would love another opportunity to speak with you.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm just grateful to connect with folks who have shared that common spirit and concern for the mm-hmm. planet. So I'm happy to come back anytime. Okay.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. Let's keep on forging these connections between the two institutions. I think that's a good intention to have.
Wonderful. Take care. Thanks. Good to meet you, Stefan. Thanks, Jonathan.
Take care.
Be well.
Bye-bye. Be well. Thank you.
Bye.